So welcome all. Welcome to any new people we have with us tonight. As always, we welcome guests at any of our meetings. You can come as often as you want. If you do want to join, I pasted a link into the chat where you can go to join the group. It's only $20 a year. Or you can go to our homepage and just click on the join or renew button at the top, and that'll take you through the process. Later on tonight, the contents of the chat, the slide deck in PDF format, and the audio track will be going up on our website, thanks to Alan. And with that, we got a lot of items on the agenda tonight, so I'm going to turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Are you going to mute everybody, Chris?
Yes, I'm doing the mute all, and as usual, everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment, and remute yourself afterwards. Thanks for the reminder.
Okay, that's the question. Let's get right to it. If you want to ask a question, some people don't like to just butt in using their microphone, and it can be problematic because you can end up with two or three people trying to talk at once, and that doesn't really work very well. So how do you actually ask a question in Zoom? And it turns out there are basically two ways, three ways, I guess, if you just say open your mic and talk. But the polite ways, you can actually put your question in the chat box, and lots of people do that. And Chris and I monitor that as we go along, and we'll either leave things to the end, or if it's pertinent to what's being discussed, then we might break in and ask the speaker to clarify whatever has been asked. And the second method is not really used very much. Tom's used it a couple of times, I think. If you haven't been to any of the APCUG Wednesday workshops, they use this thing exclusively and have really tight control over their meetings, but it actually does work very well. There's a command here which lets you raise your electronic hand, and it actually works very well. I'll show you that in just a second. So first of all, the chat window, if you look on the bottom of the Zoom screen, you'll find a whole bunch of icons. And just to the left of that green button, which is share your screen, when you're allowed to do that by the host, to the left is the chat icon. And if you hit the chat icon, then this window pops up, and you can actually start chatting with people. So here's my Zoom chat window, and I'm entering a message here to everybody. And I just say, this is a demo. So if you're on the other end, if your chat window is open, and this is kind of what you see. You see my message, here's the, hi everyone, here's the demo. And down below here, you can actually send a reply or enter any kind of question or comment that you want to do in the chat window. So for example, I could ask a question here, or you could ask a question here, and can you tell me how best to ask a question? So you've actually typed this into a message box, and now you can either hit enter, and if you hit enter, then your message is immediately sent. So if you're trying to do multiple lines, you'll end up with multiple messages doing it that way. Or you type everything you want, and then you can hit this blue arrow here. So now, because you've replied to essentially everybody, or you sent this message to everybody, Chris and I are looking at that and saying, yes, here's the question, how you ask a question. So I can do the same thing. I can just type in a reply, and I can say, well, maybe you'd like to raise your hand. And to do that, select react and click on this, and there you go. So again, looking down on that bottom window here, here's the green share screen icon. Here's chat, two to the left. And here's this icon that says react. And if you hit react, then you get all this pretty colored menu here. And I've highlighted the bottom button here, which is raise your hand. So if you click on raise the hand, then what happens is your thumbnail in the participants list basically comes to the top. And you get this yellow electronic hand in the top left-hand corner. So Chris and I, if we remember, we watch the participants list. And if somebody raises their hand, then we can break in and ask the question of the speaker or whatever. So that raising the hand is actually a really neat way to do things. We talked about this chat window, and this has changed in the last couple of weeks, I think. It never used to be quite so sophisticated as this, or it used to be easier to use, I guess, is one way to put it. But here you can see there's a chat window, and on the left-hand side here is the chat with everybody, the main chat window. So this is kind of the old style of doing things. All the chats ended up in here, and the personal ones got mixed up with that, but you couldn't actually see them if you weren't being direct messaged. But now, if you have a chat with individuals, which sometimes people call it direct messaging. So here I'm talking in the background with Chris Taylor. I'm saying, boy, you know, that Linda Buskey, she's a bit of a nuisance. We should mute her or throw her out of the Zoom session or something like that. I don't know. Make Chris's life miserable. But basically, I can chat with Chris individually as a direct message. Chris and I see what's going on, but nobody else does. If you're just using a regular chat window, if you click on the everyone chat thing here, it says new chat, control and N. So you can either just click on this button for a new chat or do a control N. And when you do that, you will get this option to, this is a demo session with just me and me. So searching is only, I can only search for another attendee. But if this was a regular chat, then there'd be a whole bunch of people down here, and you could click on somebody to chat with, or you could search for, Bob Harris or something like that, and then do a new chat specifically with him individually. So those are the two ways to ask questions. Certainly put anything you want in the chat, or use that react button and raise your hand. There we go. We look forward to seeing your questions. Chris.
Yeah, okay, thanks, Dan. So this is an interesting thing I came across that I put in as a computer basics. If you're on websites, and sometimes you'll see links, and it might actually specify that it's a link to https://opcug.ca, or it might just show something like opcug or something like that, but it's underlined as a hyperlink. And so Leo has a very good video on how to determine where links are actually going to take you. So what you see on the web page might not be the same as where clicking on that link will actually take you. So some tips he has, hovering the mouse over the link will usually show you the destination, either as a tooltip or a status bar message down at the bottom. If you're on mobile, on a phone, if you long press the link, you'll get a pop-up that shows you where the destination is actually going to be. Or you can right-click on the link and then choose an option, copy link, and that'll put the link on the clipboard, and you can then examine it. So you can paste it in to the address bar, but don't hit enter yet. It'll actually show you the full URL that you're going to, and if you're happy with that, you press enter and you go there. Or if you're not happy, you just press escape, or delete out the characters or whatever. Or you can paste it into an editor such as Notepad and examine the link there before you actually go to it. So, again, if what you see on the web page doesn't match the destination, what do you do about that? Well, it doesn't necessarily mean it's malicious. So, for example, I gave you, I could have a link that says opcug.ca, or just opcug, or Ottawa PC User Group, and it actually is going to take you to our specific URL. Doesn't mean it's malicious. I'm just making the page look a little bit friendlier. So, Leo has a whole bunch of tips on how to determine whether something might be malicious or something is harmless. So I highly recommend checking out the YouTube video, and I will paste that into the chat. And that's all I have for that.
And the next one's yours too, Chris.
Okay, let me just paste this one before I go on. Okay, yeah, this came in courtesy of Karen, and she has Malwarebytes. They have a weekly, I think it is, a newsletter, and all about dangerous things in the security world on computers. Personally, I think that they are trying to make a little bit of a name for themselves, so they blow things a little bit out of proportion. But this was kind of an interesting one. So what it was that scammers are getting people to phone them. And how do they do that? They don't compromise the actual website that they're trying to get you to go and give up personal information or anything like that. What they do is they put up a fake search listing. And that search listing goes to the proper website, but it goes to the search page on that website and inserts some text saying, phone me. And if you are not very careful about it, you might end up having a problem where you see a web page, you've gone to, Amazon or whatever. It goes to a web page at Amazon. The URL looks good, but it actually is going to the search page, and it's actually coming up in the search box showing something like please call and an 800 number or whatever, and you call that, and you're going to the scammer's phone rather than the regular website's support phone. So just something that be aware of, and I'll paste that into the chat as well. Something you can read a little bit more details into that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And here's something else to be just aware of. One of the members brought this to my attention, that Microsoft will delete all your passwords in 1 month. But you will need to read the details here, because basically what they're talking about is that this only applies if you're using Microsoft Authenticator, which is essentially a password manager app. And they changed the way that that does business. As of June, it won't save new passwords for you. As of July, you can't use autofill when you go to a website and use a user ID and password that you've saved in the password manager. In August, they're going to delete all the stored passwords. But the authenticator, this Microsoft Authenticator app, in future will support passkeys. I don't know what that means if you don't have an operating system that will support passkeys, because my understanding is Windows 10 doesn't. But if you do support passkeys, if you use Microsoft Authenticator, then you probably need to find out about passkeys. And I did a little introduction for it in February, talking about the public key, private key encrypted pair. So that's at least an introduction to the technology. And there's lots of information available about that on the web.
Before we go away from that, this was a curious one, because when I saw it in the pre-meeting deck that Alan and I assembled, I decided to look, because I do use the Microsoft Authenticator as an authenticator app, and I went into it and I noticed that, there's a password section. And I went into that password section. I had a whole bunch of passwords for sites that I don't know where they came from, because I had some that I don't have passwords in any other place. I had some where it was an old password that had been updated years ago. So I never used the Microsoft Authenticator as a password manager. I used it as an authenticator, and that was fine. And that will continue to function that way, but they're going to remove all those passwords, which is fine by me, because I was never using it as a password manager.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Only Microsoft.
Next up, we have more security, and Harvey's got a tale about TailScale.
There we go. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
All righty then. That's quite the name, TailScale. It's a company based in Toronto. It was active, let's say, April 2020. That link there, I would recommend that people use that link to become more familiarized with the company and some of the technical background of the VPN that they have developed. So this TailScale uses open source software to essentially create a mesh VPN. And the open source software is called WireGuard. It's a popular VPN protocol. Now, the company, they say, provides zero config VPN as a service under the same name. So if you're running Windows, you'll see in the services section a service called TailScale. Now, you can run this with Linux, and it'll also show up as a TailScale daemon, and it runs in the systemd service. I'm not familiar with that, but, of course, Alan could explain that very well, I bet. Okay, now, because it's running as a service, when you start your computer, that starts up that service and makes it active. Now, whenever you're, let's say, I'm calling it away from home, you can access any device from where you are using your laptop, and you can connect in, and it's free. Now, they do have plans, but I like free better. Now, it is very secure. The good thing about this, and I was researching it for my client, is I don't have to make any changes to the router, so that's called port forwarding. I don't have to worry about any public IPs. I don't have to do anything with firewalls. Now, that's not really true about the firewall. They do caution you to check, but I've found during the installation that it's very complete, and it does set up the firewall settings very well. Okay, Alan, we can go next. All right, now, for setting up this software for remote access, now I call this your remote laptop or a PC plus a Windows server. Now, the term Windows server could mean some other desktop you might have at home that you want to connect to, that type of thing, or a laptop. And essentially, you're going to this download link, and we're going to be installing this TailScale software on both devices. And what we need to do for that is to sign in with your Google account. And it's signed in the same account on both devices. Now, once you do all that, it will assign to each device a private IP that starts with 100. Now, on the server side, or the Windows server side, I enable remote desktop. And what I'm planning to do then is, on my laptop side, I'm going to use the remote desktop capability to connect to the server. All right, you can go on to the next one, Alan. Now, once you install your software on both of the computers, the GAH server is the server computer for my client. And as you can see, the address that has been set up for it. And it shows what software is being used, so Windows 10 right now. And the Inspiron is my laptop that I set up for testing. And the Google account, as you can probably see there under each of the device names, it is identical for each device. So that's what you have to put in. Now, my laptop is running Windows 11. So when I when I do the Windows 11, I'm going to be using the remote desktop connection from my laptop to reach that server. Okay, we can flip to the next one, Alan. Okay, so on the laptop or the PC, whichever you're using as the so-called client, you're going to go into your remote desktop connection. You're going to put in the computer address, and it's going to prompt you initially to put in the username and password that you're going to be connecting at the server. Now, the other side, the server side, it's just showing information. Now, it does, again, if we clicked on network devices and all that stuff and preferences, you would see more information, but this just shows that Tail Scale has connected to that device, and we're all ready to go. Now, this works extremely well. It's very fast. My client is planning, what's the word? He's planning to downsize his business and essentially run it out of his home. And we do have a server that he uses for management software. And so that server would be moved to his home. And, of course, he also has client machines that he can use. But he's also planning to use mobile. So he's going to have a vehicle, whether it's a van or a car or whatever, going to be set up with his computer, his laptop. He's going to have to use a hotspot type switch to get his internet connectivity. And from that mobile setup, he can then use this VPN to connect back to his home onto the server, do whatever he has to do when he's visiting his client. He can. We don't want to use printers in the mobile because when you're starting to plug in these devices, you're going to get a very high wattage. So it's probably best to implement a email type. You print off a PDF file or save a PDF file and then email it to your client afterwards. But that's how he wants to get around it, and it works very well. Is there any other questions?
No, there weren't. There weren't, Harvey. Thank you very much for that.
Alrighty. Thank you.
Okay, so next up we have an interesting question from Elder. And he took a whole bunch of pictures at pizza night and wanted to put them into a folder so he could create a link and send them to other people. But when he tried uploading from the gallery app to Google Drive, the pictures went as individual images, individual files, and he found that to be rather time-consuming and problematic, I guess. So he wants to know how can he create a folder in Gallery that he can send the complete folder basically as a link. So Elden sent me a screenshot of his smartphone, and this is the Gallery app, and this is the problem. This is the Gallery app, which is developed by Google themselves and is available from the Play Store. So I tried installing this, and sure enough, you can't identify a folder to do anything useful with. So Perplexity, I asked it, and it said, well, it's a lightweight photo and video gallery and designed for organization. And you can select multiple photos within a folder and share them at once, it says, whatever that means. However, it says directly sharing an entire folder is not supported within the gallery app. So you can't actually choose a folder and share it. If you go to the Play Store and you type in gallery, one of the problems is you get a dozen galleries. And, you know, here is gallery, gallery, gallery photo, lock gallery, Google Photos, and simple gallery. And so it's sometimes difficult to find, sort the wood from the trees and find out what you want. But supposing you don't choose the gallery app by Google, and instead you choose this gallery, photos, and videos app, which comes from somebody else. And this is the gallery app, photos, and videos app. So I tried installing this, and now I can show my folders, and you can see I got a whole bunch of folders. And with the wonders of the Android file system, I have multiple pictures, I have multiple DC, I have multiple receive file folders, and talk seems to be everywhere. The problem here is I've got internal storage and an SD card, and there are folders on both of them, and some of them have the same name. So if you're struggling with the Android file system, this is one of the problems. Just a quick aside here, though. Smartphones are really neat devices. This folder here is called GRK Fasteners, and if you need to find out what type of screw this is, you can. And it's basically on the floor, so you have to lie down and get your magnifying glass to see what's written on the head. But if you hold your phone close to it and just take a picture, then you can actually zoom this thing as big as you want, and you find out it's a GRK RSS 8X100 screw thread. So you can find out what Torx driver you need to unfasten that device. Okay, so we selected this fasteners folder. Now we have the option to share it, so let's click on that. And we can share it using Quick Share. We can turn on Bluetooth and share it over Bluetooth. But this is what Elvin wanted to do. He wanted to share it via a link. So if we click on this button here, QR code or link, then we could share this QR code, or here is the link, which will share all the files in that folder. So the answer is, you probably need to use a different gallery app to do what you want.
Or, Tom points out, you use a different computer. So as he points out, you can easily create and share folders in Google Photos if you're in a web browser. So I guess actually you could probably do it on the phone as well. Just go to Google Photos, which is what Gallery is probably looking at when you're trying to share photos. So if you actually just go to Google Photos in the browser, you could right-click a folder and share it directly from there.
Yeah, there's dozens of ways to share folders.
Yeah, I know.
And file managers too. Anyway, that's one way to do it, different Gallery app. Okay, next up, we have a tale of woe or a tale of success or something. I just need to give Debbie slide control here. Debbie must be under D's. Come on.
Often.
Debbie. Okay, yes. Debbie, we should have slide control.
Is this it there? Okay, I think I do. I'll give it a best shot. Okay, how's everybody doing there? I just wanted to relay a little bit of fun that's been going on in our house for the past about 4 days or 5 days, whatever it's been. All started back in November of 2022 when Bob got himself a new computer and he wanted to purchase Microsoft Office 21. And he bought it from, I believe it was Tech Republic. And at the time, it was an iffy deal. Should he have bought it straight from Microsoft, or can he buy it from this third party? Well, he paid $46 for it, and it's worked wonderful ever since. But now he decided he should upgrade to Office 2024. Okay. So, does he go back to Microsoft and pay the full price? Or should he do his risky search for Microsoft 2024 at some other locations? Will it be a bargain? Could it be a bust? Let's see what happens when he goes through his tech deals and his pitfalls. So, he checked out Microsoft first. Microsoft 365, of course, is the subscription-based program. Costs about $115 a year, about $11.50 a month. You do receive regular security updates, new features. You get cloud storage. So for that money, you do get some good value. But that's way more money than we really want to spend. Let's try something else. The non-subscription versions. And you have Microsoft Home and Home and Business. Home is the pretty basic one. It's $169. You could go for the Pro Plus for $273, give or take a bit, or that big Home and Business one for $319. Once again, that's a lot of money for a program. He's not working. He just likes to play with it. So, and with that Microsoft
non-subscription ones, by the way, you do receive security updates only. You do not get any cloud storage, and you don't get feature updates.
Okay. So over time, that Office 365, although it seems to be a great program, that subscription can be costly. It's the forever, forever plan. But there are alternatives. Let's go Google shopping. Now, Microsoft 2024 at Amazon costs about the same as it does at the Microsoft website itself. But there's other places you can go to. Digital License, Software Shop, Get Renewed Text. What else was there? There was Software Supply. And they all go for about $30 to $46. Yeah, certainly getting better. But a little bit more shopping. And we came across, Bob, I should point that out. This was Bob. Came across GameFlip. And for the price of $4.99 U.S., he could get Office 2024 Professional. What do you think he did, guys? Well, he whipped out his old credit card and said, let's buy this one. And so it was $4.99. They do charge us a processing fee of 80 cents or something. It came to $5.79. Please remember this is U.S. funds, so it does cost a little bit more. Not much, but he picked it up. And they were really good about delivering it. Got the email almost instantly with the key and a few little instructions we should do. And so, yes, he gets started. And then he goes and he enters his product key. And what comes up? Service unavailable. We are currently experiencing technical difficulties. Please try again later. Well, that's exactly what he did. He tried it later, and then he tried it later again. Still didn't work. He worked on it for a few hours, I hate to say that, tried taking out Office 21, didn't work. He just could not get it to work, so he sent them a note telling them, hey, guys, this isn't working. And their issue resolution guys responded with, we'll respond in 4 days. This is day 5, and we're still waiting to see whether or not we're going to be getting our $5.75 back. So, pending resolution on this one. That one was a bust. Just to let you know, no bargain there. So, let's find a better deal. There is a place called productkeys.com. Technically, when we log in, it says productkeys CA. And they offer the Office suites, different ones. They were offering the Professional Plus for $31.90. The Office Home was $147, and the Home and Business, $193. All pretty good deals. Now, which one do you think he went for? Absolutely, the $31.90. There it is. Heading off to our cart. He's getting ready to check out. And then, there in the little bottom left corner, it says apply coupon. Oh, we didn't have a coupon. Let's Google it. Did a little Googling, and we got a coupon for an extra 5% off that. So, nice little credit of $1.59, and we're down to $30.31 for that whole Professional Plus deal, guys. Is it a bargain yet? Let's find out. So, I hate to tell you, Bob spent hours and hours trying to get this one to work. They gave us a great site. They gave us all the instructions. Their help desk was pretty good, even though it was in Norway, by the way. And he uninstalled 21. He cleared out every cache he could that would contain any of the Office stuff, went into the registry, played around there. Could not get it to work, not at all. So, but no worries. They did tell him that if he can't get it to work, they would give him a refund. Well, I'm happy to report that as of 4 o'clock today, we got an email saying, yep, they're going to give us back our money. So, although it wasn't a
bust, because we got our money back, it really wasn't much of a bargain for them either. But I would like to say that with Product ECA, he did go to that website based on my recommendation. I had picked up a new computer earlier this year, and in May, I went to Product ECA, and I bought the exact same program. And for me, it was quick, easy, seamless install. It works perfectly, absolutely no problems. The only difference I could see or think about was I had a new complete computer that was clean. It had no previous installs. There was nothing to interfere. That's the only thing I can think of. So although it was a bust for Bob, it was a bargain for me. Let's see. So if you happen to be thinking of replacing your Microsoft Office, by the way, they do have multiple packages that are available. You can get the Home and Student, which is pretty basic, right up to the Professional Plus, which has just about anything you might want. It has the Word, Excel, PowerPoint, OneNote, Outlook, Publisher, Access, and something with Skype Exchange. Anyway, figure out what's best for you and have some fun with it. Just a little reminder here that for the perpetual Office releases, Microsoft is providing usually up to 5 years of the security updates. So Office 19 is going to stop doing security updates as of October this year. The 2021 version will be October of next year. And my lovely version of 24, we are thinking it's going to go to October 29, but we haven't really heard yet. So, anywho, bargain or bust? It was actually both. So, thanks a lot. If you have any questions, hey, send them on over.
There was a question, but I think you answered it. And the question was, if you get all the programs like Outlook.
You do on the Professional Plus and the Pro.
Right. And Tristan suggested that if you don't do well with that first guy, you could try recovering the funds by opening a dispute with your credit card provider.
That is true. Yeah, we can go that route as well. I mean, it's $4.99. What can I say?
Oh, that was U.S.
I know. You're right. It's got to be worth way more than that.
And the other thing is, clearly the answer here is you shouldn't let Bob install anything. You should install it.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, well, yeah, I have to admit that I did sit beside him for a lot of it, and it kind of stumped me, too, so.
Okay, thanks.
Actually, the clear answer is he just really should have a new computer.
Yeah, thanks, Debbie, and thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, we have part two of the disk imaging series that we started because due to the this topic coming second in our poll of what people wanted to know about. Last time we were talking about full disk backups, and now I wanted to touch on incremental backups as another way of doing backups. But first of all, we installed ESUS to do backup, and the next time you start it up, you basically see this pop-up window suggesting that you should create an emergency disk. And you really should do this, but this is going to be part four of the series. We'll get to that in future. So really the main screen is going to look like this. You remember last time we did a full backup. So we have this tile up here on the left. Disk zero is our full backup that we made last time. You can see that it says we such a date and such a time the backup was successful. Now this time I want to do a backup of just a data partition, not the whole drive. So I'm going to choose this button that says New Backup. And now I'm going to uncheck this box here to uncheck all of the partitions and then just check this one partition right here. So in my on my machine right now, I'm only interested in doing an incremental backup of my data disk drive D partition. So I choose a single partition, I choose OK. And now, rather than calling it local disk D, notice this little icon here, this little pencil almost grayed out. This is the edit name button. So if you click on that, then it will let me change this name from local disk D, and I decided I was calling it data disk because that's how I refer to my dedicated data drive. So I can save this change, and now I've got data disk here. So I've chosen only the D partition, right? So this is my source, only the data disk partition. By default, it's chosen the last thing I did, which was to back up to drive P, which is my external USB drive, the Z images folder, and the ESUS subfolder. And I'm happy with that because you'll see in a second that ESUS takes care of everything else. So we can just say back up now. And you can see here in the ESUS subfolder, here is that full disk backup partition, disk zero, and here's the new one, data disk. We click on that and you'll see that we've got a backup of the data disk partition on this particular date. It's a full backup of that partition and it's a PVD file, which is the ESUS to do backup file format. So we essentially created a full disk image of the data partition. So now let's go back to the main screen and we'll choose data disk again, but this time let's right click on this tile. So we right click on the tile, oops, not that. Right click on the tile, then we get this menu here where we can do all kinds of things to this, this data disk. What I want to do is select backup. And when I select backup, I get the option to do full backup, incremental backup, or differential backup. I want to do this time, I want to do an incremental backup. So I'm going to choose incremental backup and tell it backup now. And when the smoke clears, you'll see that now I've got two backups of data disk in this folder. I've got the original one, which is the full backup. And now I've got the first incremental backup. And you notice that the full backup was about 7 megabytes. The incremental backup is only, that's 7 gigabytes. Yeah, 7 gigabytes. The incremental backup is only 22 megabytes. So a really much smaller backup image and hence much faster. So it runs really quickly and I get a whole bunch of smaller files as incremental backups. And I can restore these and we'll find out all about that next time. But just in passing again, just as we can right-click on data disk to create an incremental backup, I can right-click on the disk zero option. Remember that? That's essentially my full disk image saved procedure, if you like. So I can right-click on it. I can choose backup. I can choose do a full backup. So that will do a second backup of my hard drive. So in other words, I don't need to create a new backup every time. I can just do right-click incremental or right-click full backup, and whatever kind of backup I want on whichever disk I want, it will do that for me. So next time we're going to look at how to restore the data that we've just backed up.
Okay, we have two questions. Tom asked, what's the difference between incremental and differential?
Incremental does the changes in the disk since the last time you ran an incremental. Differential does the changes in the disk since the last time you did the full backup as the master backup file. So in other words, if you want to restore, you want to restore a differential backup, You first restore the master, then the first differential, then the second differential, then the third differential, then the fourth differential.
And incrementals.
incremental, yeah. The first, second, third, fourth, and incremental backups, and now you're back to where you were when you made that fourth incremental backup. The software does all that for you. You don't have to worry about it, but it basically restores the master and then restores all of the incrementals. In the differential backup, you choose a differential backup. The software restores the master and that differential, because that differential has all the differences between the time you made the differential and the master. So when you do a differential restore, you only need the master and one differential file. Now, clearly, the differential files are going to get bigger with time because it's got to accommodate all of the changes that were made between the differential and the master. So it's really just a question of which way you like to do things.
Yeah, the biggest difference between incremental and differential, say you do incremental backups, or you do your backups every day. Okay, so say you do the first full backup is going to be on, say, Sunday, and then you do backups every day. So if you do incrementals, you could actually do restore from, by the time you get to the next weekend, you could restore to the point it was on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday or Friday and so forth as you go along. If you do differential backups, there will only ever be two files. So it'll be the master or the full backup, and then there will be one differential file which will be created on whatever day. So if I go to do a restore on Thursday, I can only restore the full backup from Sunday, or I could restore Thursdays. I can't restore Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. So those, to me, are the big differences in terms of recoverability between incrementals and differentials.
Okay, Tom has his hand up now. You must have answered his question because it's gone away.
Okay. And, yeah, he did also ask, are all backups security protected?
Security protected.
Yeah, that I can answer that one.
It's a binary file, so you have to have the software to open them. But,
they're
on my physical external hard drive, so pretty secure.
Well, actually, I can answer to that. You can actually create encrypted backups, and the password is only required to do a restore once you set it up, so it'll happily do the backup. But if you ever go to do a restore, you have to provide the password that you created when you created the job. To me, I don't worry about it terribly on local hard drives or when it's stored locally. When I do offsite backups, I definitely do encryption either through EASA Studio Backup, or I use a drive that has hardware encryption built into it so that everything on that drive is encrypted with a password.
I only encrypt files that I encrypt specific files or folders that I'm concerned about. I never encrypt the whole drive. Anyway, there we go. Different strokes for different folks. Okay, we got lots of time. A question came in here this afternoon, and a friend gave this individual a cell phone, actually a Samsung S7, but he couldn't remember his password, so he was still the nominal user of this phone. And now the member here wants to use the phone, but Google wants her to sign in. But it shows his account, not the member's, and she doesn't know how to proceed. Now, my first thought and Chris's first thought was, well, you just perform a factory reset. You go into the settings menu, you find go back to a factory reset. That will get rid of everything, all the previous user's data, and then you basically start over. You set up the phone just as if it were a new device. However, while we're searching for this thing, I looked on Perplexity, and I got simple instructions how to find the factory reset for an S7. Chris used a slightly different search term and got a whole raft of information, one of them which was, it may still require the previous user's login credentials, and the phone might not work. That doesn't seem reasonable to me. If you do a factory reset, everything should go away. So I can't imagine that it would still be requiring the previous user's login credentials. But the question is, has anybody ever done this? Has anybody ever done a factory reset on an Android smartphone or tablet? And did you have any problems? So if everybody's going to raise their hand or put something in the chat or...
Just while we're waiting for a response from anybody else, my first thought on that, why it might be true, is as an anti-theft precaution, I guess, on the part of the manufacturer, in this case Samsung, that they say, well, if they allow people to do a factory reset, then anybody could steal your phone and they've got a phone. But if they make it so that you can't just do a factory reset and then use it, then you're less likely to steal it if it's a brick when you steal it. And so I think maybe there's something to that. I don't know. I don't have any experience.
Yeah, Tom thinks that you need the PIN or the password to do the factory reset.
Harvey, you had your hand up.
I was just typing. I was going to say I've done a reset on a Motorola phone, and there was no prior user information there afterwards. So I'm not
and it
sure.
was usable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I would have expected, Harvey.
Yeah, I think it's the original owner who needs to do the factory reset. But I have a couple of phones, but again, they came without a user. No.
Yeah, well, the trouble is, Tom, the original user doesn't remember his password, so he can't log on.
Yeah. The actual wording of the caution from Perplexity was Google Samsung account lock. After the reset, the phone may require the Google or Samsung account previously associated with the device to activate it again, FRP lock. If you don't have those credentials, you may not be able to use the phone.
Maybe it works if you have the original owner provide their face or however else, or their fingerprint, however else they logged in. That might be enough to get the factory reset log in again. But usually for extra stuff like this, they usually require the PIN. That you originally had.
Hmm.
Okay, more research needed, I think.
So
we'll
like
come
it.
Back to that. I don't think I have a Samsung phone that I want to play with, but I've certainly got other phones I can play with. Last item. I was using File Explorer in Windows, and it suddenly decided that it was going to take all kinds of time to open what I use as downloads folder. And so there's this green progress bar and crawling across the screen and this working on it message. And then, you know, eventually it populates with all the files and folders in this folder. And I Googled to see what was going on, and it said that the fix was to actually clear the cache. So what you have to do is to go to, on the C drive, go to users, and then your username, whatever that happens to be, and then go to the app data folder, and note that app data is a hidden folder, so you have to enable showing hidden folders. And then under app data, you go to roaming, Microsoft Windows, and recent. And that's the cache folder. So you press Control A, that selects all of the files in that folder, and press Delete, and that clears all the cache files. And that came from this Tech Cult online source, and it seemed to work fine. So if you ever have that problem where Windows is taking an age to load File Explorer, then try clearing the cache. Okay, anybody have any other questions? Anybody want to try raising their hand and saying hi? we got 4 minutes, people.
Yeah, we had a couple of other comments on that phone issue. Timothy saying that what I said was what he was trying to write down. So it looks like, at least on some phones, it may be an issue if you don't have something to do with the credentials of the original owner, that you might end up with a brick. So we'll see if we can find out more information.
Okay, so everybody's shy. So let's go to the wrap-up slides, and I'll just note that Chris and Linda have been busy getting ready for the fall, and at the library there are a couple of presentations scheduled already, one for September, Protecting Your PC at Carlingwood, and then if you want to know all about Iceland, Linda has one of her armchair travel series in October. And as you know, I'm now the meeting coordinator. We have meetings planned. These are the monthly meetings. So starting in September, we have sessions planned for September, October, November, and December. But if you have a presentation that you'd like to give in the new year, that means you have lots. You've got basically 6 months to think about what you want to do, create the presentation, and think about how you're going to do it. Please send me some information, and I'll be glad to help you schedule a time for your presentation or whatever. And if you have any other questions or topics that you'd like to share at Q&A, then this is the summer break for our monthly meetings. But as long as we have material, I guess Chris and I will be doing Q&A every week. So next yep. Wednesday is the 9th, and if you have any questions, send them along.
We do have one question from Elizabeth in the chat, an iPhone question. Whenever I open the CBC Listen app, it always seems to be running, except that the right arrow is not clicked. Not sure what that means. Maybe iPhone users know what it means. My question is, would this app be using resources? I can speak a little bit to resources on a phone. I used to, on my Android phone, always shut down apps and close them when I was not using them, thinking they were using up resources and so forth. And I did a little bit of research on it, and I've stopped doing that because it says that, at least on Android, and I suspect that iPhone would be the same, they are very good at putting apps to sleep so that when they are not actively being used, they do not use system resources. And so I stopped doing that on my Android phone, and I have not noticed any difference in terms of battery life or anything like that.
For what it's worth,
the right arrow might be that I think when you open the CBC media player thing, you get the choice of all kinds of different music streams. You choose it, but then I think you have to start it. So that might be the right arrow.
Okay.
Well, okay, it's my question. Sorry for the confusion. Like, I'm looking at this thing now, and I open up the CBC Listen app, and at the bottom, there's the Craig Norris thing that's running like a stock exchange ticker from right to left constantly whenever this is open. But it's not playing because I haven't clicked on, you know, when you want to click to play something, there's a little arrow that sort of points in the right direction. Right. And when you stop it, there's a double line or something, for want of a better word. So anyway, I just wondered, like, when I don't leave this open, I swipe it away so it closes, but I'm just wondering, it's still there. Every time I open this up, it's got this little ticker tape thing at the bottom going across whatever is playing on CBC Listen currently for Ottawa.
Herbie had a comment in the chat. He said that running but right arrow not clicked issue on the CBC Listen app likely indicates background process or setting interfering with the app's normal operation. To resolve this, try restarting the app, checking for updates, reviewing background activity settings on your device, especially if you're using Android. So I guess that doesn't apply, but... I don't know whether it's really an issue, or it might be that it's just when you're not actively using it, that it might be just sleeping and nothing really impacting the performance of your device.
For what it's worth, I always close my Android apps when I'm done with them. It's just simpler to wipe them up, and then I don't have to kind of pick and choose from a list of apps that are open. I just go to open them again, and it's instant. So it's not so much the resources when they're running that matters, because if they're writing like a barometer or something, or even Podcast Addict, they run whether they're open or closed if they're going. It's rather the RAM that it uses up. I figure it's faster if I just get rid of them.
And yeah, it's not like Android apps are slow to load or anything anyway, so they're all very quick to load. So
there's a question there. If anybody has used an app called ID.me, an app from the Norwegian Cruise Line. Bob says some issues on his iPhone are resolved with a reboot. And Darlene says she had trouble setting up an account with ID.me and couldn't get out of the multi-factor authentication. Reached a human to request the account be deleted, but the problem is she needs to set up an account. So if anybody knows anything about ID.me, let us know, and we'll revisit that again next week. Okay, so that's it in terms of all the material. Thanks to Harvey and Debbie and everybody who had comments and things on the material here. If you have questions, remember, or topics that you'd like to share, like Debbie and Harvey did this week, just send us a note to suggestion box and we'll be happy to add you to the agenda. So we'll see everybody next Wednesday.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.